Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Poe Ballantyne, author of the new book Whirl Away, the great American loony bin, horse playing, and record collecting novel published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. Poe has published 7 books and hundreds of stories and essays, many of which have appeared in the Sun magazine along with the Atlantic Monthly and the Coal City Review. And his work has won 2 pushcart prizes and has been included in the anthologies The Best American Short Stories 1998 and The Best American Essays 2006. Poe's memoir, Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere, was adapted for a documentary film, which won the 2015 Toronto International Film Festival Hot Doc Award and the Big Sky Award given to the film that captures the spirit of the American West. Portland writer and musician Willie Vlaunton calls Whirl Away a fevered dream of my favorite things, horse racing, records, booze, insanity, and women. What a estranged and crazed comedic ride. Ballantyne's writing is like no other. And in the words of novelist Tom Robbins, Poe Ballantyne is the most soulful, insightful, funny, and altogether luminous, underknown writer in America. He knocks my socks off even when I'm barefoot. Poe Ballantyne, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Poe, your publisher at Hawthorne Press, Rhonda Hughes, when we were at the Powell's reading, referred to you as, quote, our Bukowski. And I think she meant that, like Charles Bukowski, you show great loyalty by continuing to publish with the same independent press, Hawthorne Press in your case, certainly, and Black Sparrow Press and Bukowski's. Bukowski himself even makes a cameo appearance in Whirl Away. He must be somewhat of an influence on your work.
I would say so, and we do share similarities in that we're Southern California writers and that we both...
horse racing.
And the horse racing angle. We eschewed the academic route, and we also, you know, had a lot of crummy jobs and lived in a lot of crummy rooms. And
stuff. I want to talk about that a little. In a previous interview, you answered the question, what strongly held belief did you have at 18 that you do not have now? You said that you had to be self-destructive to be an artist.
Right.
Fortunately, that's something you grew out of, huh?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I think that very few people are successful, except for maybe a short burst. And then they, if they are sots and libertines, and they believe that's the origin of their creative drive or whatever, you know, they're not going to last very long. And it's interesting to write about, to read or write about that kind of thing. Everybody sort of gravitates, I think, to self-destruction. But after a while, I think it's kind of juvenile. There's lots of, and why not grow as a human being in as many ways as you can and report that? I don't see the problem with that.
Now, we'll talk a little bit about your early life. You describe it as a drifter slash hobo-like life. You hitchhiked out of San Diego at age 18 and spent the next 20 years, quote, living in furnished rooms and residential motels in over 60 cities and taking over 80 low-paying jobs, mostly in restaurants, factories, and warehouses. At Powell's, you mentioned you would take, say, $1,000 and just travel to a small place where that would go a certain distance, you know, several months, several years, whatever. What were the reasons for that? Was that to gather material for your writing?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. You know, I definitely was an exploratory. It was, you know, it had multiple functions in my mind. I didn't really. The primary motivation wasn't to gather material. The primary motivation was to test myself, to discover who I was. By the same token, I wanted to find out what America was, and I really wasn't sure what I was going to do with all this. I just wanted to go a different direction than everyone else. And it took me a while to refine that system of town to town, saving $1,000. And I didn't really come clear to me until my late 30s what I was doing and what I would write. But, this is basically what I'm known as.
Now, you published your very first book with Rhonda Hughes and Hawthorne Press. It was September 2002. The book was Things I Like About America, Personal Narratives by Poe Ballantyne. How did that relationship start with Hawthorne Press and Rhonda?
I'd had a marvelous contract with Houghton Mifflin, a multi-book contract that blew up. Some of it was my fault. I wrote an essay about it and blamed it all on my editor, but much of it was my fault.
And
it was,
she didn't like certain words like something and
And yellow.
Color yellow.
And that all came apart, and it forced me to go back out. I thought that at that point when I'd signed the contract that I would be independent and that I would be, you know, an artist untroubled by having to return to factories and so forth. But that made me have to return to the rooms and the factories and the low budget lifestyle. And I just gathered more and more material, much more material than I thought I needed, and I still have a lot of this material that I haven't, addressed. Not that I need to write about every last thing I ever did, but so that was good for me. And I really needed, for whatever reason, I've always been a late bloomer, slow grower, and so this is just another example. So I'm really not even hitting my stride, knowing what I'm doing technically and personally, until I'm in my early 40s, you know. And I'm still learning. You know, I like your one of your heroes, Jerry Garcia, once had the quote about he hoped that one day he'd learn how to play the guitar. I think he's really being serious about.
I agree with you
about craftsmanship, and it's the same. It's the same with writing. I think it's important to keep your humility and to keep. What's your job? You're reporting the world to other people. What do you need to do? You need to know a lot about it, and you need to be able to give your reader something other than just your opinions and your old hat, rehashed life story.
So after the Houghton Mifflin contract kind of fell through, Rhonda contacted you? Is that how your first book was published?
Yeah, the timing was perfect because I had won the Best American Short Story for Blue Devils of Blue River Avenue, and that's basically what launched me. They took a flyer on me. And so we were working on short pieces. And then after that, I assumed that we would move to novels and all the rest of this backlog that I had that I just needed to polish up. But then when that fell apart, and Rhonda contacted me, we didn't do short stories. And I had trouble with short stories because I had gotten into a kind of a mode where I was writing real life, because my real life story was much more interesting, at least to most of the readers who contacted me and said, because when I had a story published, I didn't really get a great deal of response. But when I published an essay, there would be, a palpable reaction that I knew was important for whatever reason. I still hadn't figured it out yet. So she just wanted to do essays, real life stories, real life action. But, in many ways, because of my exposure and my interest to fiction, I've learned how to write a story, and I know how to make these transitions and points of conflict and stuff that so that's what I did. And so she got a hold of me, and I still insisted that we do half fiction, and because I'd had all these stories that I wanted to use, some of them, but she just threw all the fiction out, and it remains unpublished except for the ones that have been anthologized.
You mentioned at Powell's, too. It was interesting, Poe. You didn't know you were writing an essay. It was kind of, you considered it short fiction, and Sun thought it was an essay where you were publishing.
Yeah.
And it turned out you got more response and more money.
They gave me more money. They gave me more money for it was my third or fourth piece, which was a story. And then the next piece, they gave me less money. And I said, what's the deal here? And they said, well, we thought that last one was an essay. and that was a sort of a point of illumination. I didn't care about essays. I didn't really read very many essays. Or if I did, I didn't think of it as an essay. Because the essay is this sort of horrible thing you have to do in high school.
A thesis statement and
yes,
all that.
Oh, that's exactly it. Yeah, and that everybody labors through and nobody likes. But I didn't realize it was just a true story. You know, you could actually tell a true story, and I found that that was easy for me because I had traveled to so many places and been in lots of scrapes and risky situations and places that people didn't want to go, and so all of it sort of fell together at that point. I guess it was in my late 30s.
Now I want to talk. We should get to Whirl Away, which is your new book.
Oh, there's no hurry.
And the title has several meanings. Whirl Away, of course, a racehorse that won the Triple Crown in 1941. And it's something that I didn't know here. It refers to a very rare record. There's a record collecting, the narrator and his friend Shelley in the book are record collectors and dealers. Apparently, this is one of the most, the rarest and most expensive, or actually priceless records, because right. there's only two in existence.
Right. Well, in the 1990s, when this takes place, there were only two known copies, and there was no price set on them because there's no way to set a price on something that rare.
And we should say this was a promotional 45 put
out. It was
out
by, RCA to show its users how to play the new 45 format. I think it was in 1945. It was named after the Thoroughbred Winter Whirlaway, although it has the dash in it. Issued this, and everybody, you know, they played it and they tossed it. It had a little, somebody played it at one of the bookstores, and I had never listened to it.
Wow.
But it's kind of nice. Uh-huh. But the mystery wore off with the advent of YouTube. So now you can go, and that's where they found this record. So now, and it's an interesting record, but it doesn't have any value. It doesn't have any consumer value. It only had value because it was rare.
Oh, for
so
collectors.
So at the time of this writing, it was the rarest. Oh, actually, there are records that, like the one that I cite the most was Rocket 88, mm-hmm. which was the original. Some scholars would argue, but
first rock and roll record
written
some
in 51. But the reissue, you're not going to find a 50. There's just none in existence. So it's the reissue in 1953 or 54 that's worth, or at the time it was worth about $5,000, depending on condition. Very rare, but it's the original print of the Delta Cats and Ike Turner's.
Which included Ike Turner, even though Jackie Brenston got the credit there
right,
as the singer.
Right, I don't remember exactly, but I think he wrote it. But whatever the case is, there's none. At the time of this, in the 1990s when this takes place, there are no copies available. One may have turned up. I don't want to discount the possibility. But extremely rare, and there's probably lots more examples of records that cannot be found.
So those are two meanings of the title. The third is what you said was Whirlaway describes a state of psychic evanescence. What do you mean by psychic evanescence?
Well, that's the that's when something exists and doesn't exist, either physically or in the mind, or in reality it might exist one minute, it doesn't exist in the next. And I have two examples, two primary examples. But because my narrator is schizophrenic, it might be emphasized even more clearly because he does hallucinate. That's not an official definition. I just created that myself.
But it's something that you created.
Yes.
Also at Powell's, when you talked a little bit about that, you mentioned that you yourself have something called color synesthesia, where you actually can see colors when you see words or
right.
concepts.
Right.
You mentioned the days of the week. Certain yes. days of the week are certain colors.
Right.
There's a few that are yellow or right. a few that are other colors.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm synesthetic or something.
Yeah, I don't
like
know.
That.
I just know the synesthesia. Yes, some kind of adjective out of that.
Right. Yeah. And it's fairly common, but it's mostly common with numbers. Especially these the savants.
Oh, they see colors when they see numbers.
They see shapes. The one savant that can report his experience. Most savants are just so removed from lucid communication mm-hmm. that they're not capable of describing how it is that they know these things. But the one savant is a nice documentary that the boy with the giant brain or something like that. Oh. But he talks about being able to see big numbers, and they all have different shapes. And then when he puts the shapes together, he can add or
he
multiply
can do calculations in his
massive
head,
sums. Yeah, and so, but mine was color synesthesia, and I had other synesthesia too. I have a very strange mind, and I wrote about it I wrote about it in a story called I think it was in Torpedoes de Amor, mm-hmm. but anyway. So I have color synesthesia synesthesia is where you have two different perceptual capabilities that are shuffled together. So I would see many things, but especially days of the week, which I still see. So when you say Saturday, I see black, and I don't know why, because that was my favorite day. Uh-huh. But Sunday is yellow, and then Monday is a slightly off.
So it's not nothing you have control over. It's
was assigned to me, just as many things were. My knowledge of the existence of God, mm-hmm. All of these things were just standard equipment. I think
inherent and born with that. Mm-hmm. Now, Poe, you wrote that, and I quote here: 90% of everything I have ever published was grounded in reality. So I'm interested how you decide to write something that's nonfiction or an essay versus short fiction or a novel. I also want to mention another quote from you here. Undertaking an original novel is a lottery ticket in every respect, with about the same odds of hitting a jackpot. Yet the novel for me, a confessed gambler, remains the highest goal and within my earthly purview, the greatest possible achievement.
Yeah.
Much more so than your essays and your short fiction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that just comes from being a reader. Uh-huh. And I suppose it's the... I'm not sure if it's the same anymore, but in my generation when I grew up, that would be, if you were a novelist, how much higher could you go? I mean, really, maybe movie actor or rock star. I mean, but those were not available. They were perhaps available to me, but I wasn't interested in this. So the highest echelon of popular achievement and also aesthetic achievement, you know, because the novel incorporates all aspects of human experience and thought. And if it's done right, you know, it's... you know, for me as a reader, that was the apex of human achievement.
And of course, it's monumental in terms it takes several years to write, where an essay may be a few hours to a few weeks. A short story sometimes the same way.
Sure.
Yes. Not to put those down in any way. I mean, great essays and great short fiction should be celebrated, but the novel just seems to be a little more difficult to achieve.
And the really great novel is so much more successful at accessing or achieving the great states, pursuit of the revelation of the truth, understanding of the how something might work, explanations mysteries, unsolved mysteries, not necessarily solving them, but giving you insights into them.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Poe Ballantyne, author of the new book, Whirl Away, The Great American Loony Bin, Horseplane, and Record Collecting Novel, published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. I don't have this as a question here, but it reminds me of something I read that you said, and I forgot where, in another interview, where there's certain novelists who are considered great, but there's a certain work of theirs that just has some magic involved. And you mentioned certainly Melville.
Right.
Moby Dick, his other books, maybe some people would argue, like The Confidence Man. But really, Typee, Omu, they don't really have the significance of a Moby Dick.
Right.
You mentioned that with some other writers.
Sure.
I know my favorite writer is Thomas Pynchon, and I would say that about Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah.
The other books are fantastic. He's an amazing writer in mind.
Right.
But Gravity's Rainbow definitely has something magic about it,
right.
Almost like it comes from another dimension or another world.
Exactly.
And you studied things like that, right?
Right.
How would you achieve that magic? Is that just something you got to luck into? Or
I think you have to please the gods,
mm-hmm.
and you have to put yourself at risk I to some extent. And I'm not exactly sure how far that goes, but... yeah, and it usually only happens once. You know, you talk about
like
Pynchon
a Moby Dick.
Yeah, it just happens once. So you just stand there and you keep working and you do everything in your power, and you hope to get struck once, because I think there's a whole bunch of good novelists that never got hit once. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not allowed to say whether or not magic struck me or not.
I was going to ask, but I was going to refrain.
Yeah.
It's kind of unfair.
So I don't know. I can't really. I'd like to say so, but. But it wouldn't be. I don't think it would be fair or responsible of me to judge my own work in that respect.
The readers can, and
I
would say there's definitely some magic in Poe Ballantyne's work. So
good.
I want to get into the reality behind Whirl Away. The narrator Eddie Plum is based partly on a family member, you said, who was committed to Napa State Forensic Hospital, which was formerly the Napa Asylum for the Criminally Insane.
Yeah.
And he was sent there as a, you called him a minor sex offender. Certainly he wasn't out raping people or anything.
Right.
But he was stuck there because he refused to take a simple course on sexual harassment.
Right.
And you settled on Eddie as a narrator, you said, after years of failed attempts to write Whirl Away with other narrators.
Right.
What was that like then? What were the other attempts, and why was Eddie just the right narrator? Again, Eddie's based on this family member.
Yeah. And
you had a bunch of letters, I should say, too, from the family member.
Right, yeah. This was the only time I've really ever had trouble with voice. And it was the credibility of the credibility of the narrator that I had so much trouble with, because I'm always generally writing about myself, whether I'm on a an island in the Caribbean, or if I'm an orderly in a convalescent hospital, or just traveling on a bus headed for Plainview, Texas, or something like that. It's always me, and it's easy for me to report. But to write a stable account of someone else's story, I was no longer I would have been a credible narrator. It would have worked, but it would have lacked a lot of what I got with Eddie, which was the instability, which was a secondary story, which I think is as powerful as the primary story, because he's in jeopardy after jumping ship with the help of another person. So, and that's what I was looking for. I want the book to jump. I don't want just to have a good story. I want that book to have a nice jump in it. And normally I can, because I've taken so much risk in my life, and because I have such an unusual worldview, and because I can talk about things that most people have no experience with, it's not easy, but it's almost automatic. With this was not the case, and so I struggled with that until I decided to integrate the letters. It's still me talking, because my cousin has a good sense of humor, and he's an intelligent person. He reads lots of books. But he doesn't have a particularly interesting style. He's, there's no rhythm in his speech, and he doesn't use simile and metaphor to any, which is sort of, if you know my work, then you yes. see that I'm from the definitely from the Raymond Chandler school of similes and metaphors. And so it took me a long time to take his situation, and I took a lot of his lines. The first paragraph about the patient who gets thrown through the glass display case by the
300 pound
is straight out of the letters. I just had to sort of assimilate my own experience, and I don't, just in case some of my family is listening, this is not my cousin, it's me, but I am using his letters, and I hope to some degree that that I've done him and his situation a service, because I think people will have more sympathy and understanding of how a person might end up in one of these places and never be able to get out, which is pretty much the case with my cousin, who the worst thing he did was steal suits. And then he shouted at some women at a bar, and he was in the habit of shouting at women, and he said some vile things, but I don't think he ever touched a woman, and he was just off his meds. But that... that chalked him up sexual offender status, and he was put in with sexual offenders, and he resented that, and therefore did not take the class that would have,
which was seemed like just a simple step, sexual harassment class. Is he still in Napa State?
No, he actually got oddly enough. Not oddly enough, but my narrator ends up after. Well, I won't spoil it. But
yeah.
my narrator ends up in the same place that my cousin just ended up, because he struck a med nurse. He was just tired of getting that.
Oh
hip
my!
Full of
I didn't know
held
that.
All.
Okay.
Yeah, he was in jail for 6 to 8 months, and then they moved him to Atascadero, which is maximum security. It's no fun at all. I mean, Napa State is not a picnic, but Atascadero is where they put the people who have screwed up in the more liberal, co-ed, free flowing, wear your civvies type of arrangement.
Now, a little bit more about the reality in the book. You said that an old racetrack and drinking companion of yours, who also collected and dealt records like Shelley in the book, told you one day about his brother, who died jumping from a famous San Diego sea cliff called the Clam, just north of La Jolla Cove there. And you said that, quote, years later, I was told by another friend that the brother jumped but did not die. The book was born then, though it took me 20 years to figure out all the angles.
Right.
I was wondering, Poe, what are some of those angles, and how do you go about figuring them out, just kind of plugging away?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't normally write, as with Love and Terror, I didn't write true crime, so I had to start all over with Love and Terror. And I had to not start over, but this is a purely entertainment-oriented novel, and so I'm using lots of devices, transitional devices and withholding secrets as we do in mysteries, which I bridle against, but it's the only way to tell this thing in a satisfying form. And as listeners, I don't think most of us object to a well-told story, but I was never equipped with doing clever switchback stuff where you're deliberately deceiving the reader to get a payoff at some point.
Oh, a red herring type of thing in a mystery.
Right. Uh-huh. I've taken some arduous steps to make it not it's not like so it won't read as a contrivance, I hope.
Well, I think it's just one part of the appeal of the book. There's, as you mentioned, several mysteries in there that get solved, but also there's the characters, there's the humor, there's the wisdom. There's quite a bit going on.
Yeah, so. Good. That's good. Yeah.
It's not like reading an Agatha Christie novel or something.
I hope not. Yeah,
who did it? Who done it?
Yeah.
Now, after starting out at Napa State Hospital, Whirlaway takes place mostly in Southern California, primarily San Diego. Where you grew up, at the Powell's Reading, and I lived there for a while.
Oh, okay.
My sister still lives there.
Oh, really?
Actually, not too far from the Del Mar track.
Oh.
You called it a most boring town, and you've written, I grew up in San Diego, and its dreary, blinding suburban sunlight, its empty freeways, and hypnotic beaches and war machines. I'm thinking you don't have fond memories of the place.
No. Well, I have fond memories. Mm-hmm. It's just not... it's not a very stimulating environment. It's a pretty vapid place. I think people like it that way.
Said something at Powell's, which I totally agree with. When you ask somebody in San Diego why they like it, we have perfect weather.
Yes.
Like that's the ultimate, to have perfect weather.
Yeah. That's it. It's beautiful. And that's the end of the conversation. So.
Of course, there's a lot more going on in the novel in San Diego. So. I wanted Poe to give listeners a taste of the novel. I wonder if you could please read us a passage from Whirlaway and maybe set it up a little for the listeners.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I actually have it open right here. The first six or seven chapters, let's see, let's call it six chapters, are Napa State and what it's like to be at Napa State. And it's a period of about 14 years before he gets out, before he is sprung in a surprising fashion that I won't reveal. His father's a horse trainer, a very successful horse trainer, and he's got this little a place called the Island, which is seven cabins inland from Del Mar. It's a fictional place, but there are actually lots, and especially maybe not as many as there used to be, but there are lots of places like this where the training father, the horse trainer father, he provides this for his help. Cheap, often illegal Mexican help. The Mexicans are predominant in the horse track situation. I mean, they're muckers and groomers and jockeys and so on. Jockeys are rarely illegal, but anyway, so he's in cabin number seven, I think it is, and he's gone to bed after making arrangements with Beatriz, who runs the place. The mattress on the bed was queen size, wide as a battleship, and the sheets, though dusty, were fresh with the scent of marshmallows and wound all around me like kelp around the ankles of a man washed up, exhausted on a deserted shore. I slept for 3 days, maybe it was four. Beatriz bought meals, that lentil dish with the dried corn that I liked and stacks of warm tortillas that I ate with the queso fresco. I could hear the ocean far off and the occasional pounding of hooves. Carlito, that colossal butterscotch splotch of a malevolent beast, stood under the orange tree and scowled at me through the window. Carlito is this dog that he's decided is his enemy. And then this is chapter 8, Dr. Seuss, in the sky. When my last Haldol injection wore off, I decided not to take any more. What is the purpose of liberty if you are chained to a chemistry set and jerking around spastically like a marionette on the strings of an evil puppeteer? Just say no to drugs, échale ganas. If I started spitting and raving or thinking I was Napoleon, I could always fill one of Jangler's scripts. There were dozens of pharmacists in the North County, one on every corner and one in every grocery store. Nervous was I like Dr. Seuss in the sky, and then I'd drink coffee and really fly. But my mind had not been allowed to work freely in ages, and I saw once again the infinite transcendental landscape of the mind and how everything, even death, was aperiodically interactive in quasi-crystalline symmetry. And I lay on the hardwood floor on that cracked black couch and watched the electric storms behind my eyelids and wondered maniacally about time and why, if the eardrum is simply a single vibrating membrane like a tiny trampoline, how it can discern every detail of every instrument in a symphony orchestra, along with the old man coughing next to you. And this is another reason, if you don't mind me taking it aside here, why it took me 20 years to write this thing, because this paragraph is probably a 6 years worth of rearranging things until I've got it right.
And it doesn't read like that.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, I mean, my primary purpose is to be clear, but I also want to include as much as possible and make my point as eloquently and beautifully as I can. As the drugs began to evaporate from my system, the simple beauty of my surroundings unfolded. I savored the fresh air and the clouds and the sand under my bare feet, the cool-aired supermarkets with their acres of delicacies, the crackle of a freshly opened racing form, and no one looking over my shoulder or following me down a corridor with a syringe in their left hand. Never again would I take for granted a private bathroom, the choice to drive east or west without permission, or a long walk down to the beach at night to watch the caps and veins of foam in the curling faces of the moon-painted waves. Like a child, I was once again in awe of flowing water, disheveled movie theaters, sitting around the house naked with a freshly opened tub of Cool Whip, and never once answering the phone. After 2 weeks off my meds, I also began to get my telepathic powers back. Beatrice was often away, leaving no one to watch Carlito, so he hung around scowling and growling at my door, waiting for his opportunity to maul me, and I would have gotten him first if I'd had a fireplace poker. But as the heavy haze of boundless years of pernicious and addictive medicines lifted, I realized that he was not the threat I had originally perceived. To make amends, I invited him in. He wagged his tail and said to me in so many words, "If you give me even as much as an old tortilla, I will stay here and help to heal your mind." "How did you know I had tortillas?" I asked him. "It is written all over you," he replied. "Your name is really not Carlito, is it?" "No, I am not a Mexican dog. You look like a big butterscotch sundae. Flattery will get you nowhere. From now on, I will call you Sweets. You are about the most pathetic human being I have ever seen." That made me laugh, for what Sweet said was true.
That's great. It's funny, too, Poe, because at the Powell's, you actually, we don't have to take the telepathy between Dog and Eddie as a contrivance in the novel. You actually have some scientific basis there. You mentioned the work of Rupert Sheldrake,
yes.
Who I've read, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did some extensive
living
work.
Things communicate with each other telepathically like
right,
that.
Exactly.
Not just dogs and men, but trees, plants.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, mushrooms,
there's,
fungi.
Yeah,
whole
there's something going
thing.
On there.
Yes, I think so.
We're focusing, of course, on Whirlaway, but I want to touch on your 2013 memoir, Love and Terror, on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. As mentioned in the intro, there's a documentary film based on your book and a Portland screening with you and the director, Dave Janetta, who you just picked up at the airport,
yeah.
At Portland's Hollywood Theater on June 24th. So this is a true story, actually fascinating and tragic at the same time. Maybe in a few words as possible, tell the listeners a little bit about the story. That might be unfair to ask.
Oh, I can do it. I can do it very succinctly. Yeah.
Okay, and then how it was adapted for film.
Yeah, well, my neighbor, the theoretical mathematician who'd just come to the small college to teach 3 months before, disappeared one day, 8 days before the term. And 95 days later, he was found burned and bound beyond recognition to a tree on private ranch a half a mile from the campus where he taught.
And this is Chadron,
this
Nebraska.
This is Chadron, Nebraska, western Nebraska.
About 6,000 population.
About right around there, 3,800 feet. The investigations were uninspiring, both by the police and the local police and the state police. And so I undertook the investigation myself. And it gave me an opportunity to talk about the town, which I always wanted to portray, and also my marriage, which I had been portraying, and my son and his various intriguing diagnoses. Is that short enough for you?
Oh, yes, thanks. And that's all in the documentary, too, along with
right.
the mystery. And I won't go into the mystery too much. I mean, that's
right.
that's part of the book and the movie.
Right.
But I will say, first thing that came to my mind is something one of the people interviewed, one of the Chadron residents, said in the documentary, sarcastically, "Obviously it makes perfect sense that he would kill himself by tying himself to a tree and lighting himself on fire." And yet the official police report still refers to as a suicide.
No, it does not. It's
I didn't know that.
No, if you ask any most law enforcement people, they will say it's a suicide, but it's an open case.
Oh, okay.
There's no determinant. Whatever the designation for unknown cause still remains 9 years later, or how many ever years it's been.
It just seems to me ridiculous to make a case that it's a suicide. I don't even think how that would be physically possible.
I don't understand it either. But suicide is often assigned to a case that's insoluble. It makes everything
go away.
Yeah, it makes the killer go away. It makes the investigation that was uninspiring seem to make more sense. And so it's a very handy tool for law enforcement to use. But in this case, it's a preposterous conclusion.
And I highly recommend the documentary in addition to the book. For those of you who missed the screening, and this will air after June 24th, we're airing July 5th, you can view Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere, as I did, on Amazon Prime. Free if you're a member, and you pay a little money if you're not. It's well worth it. Poe, one more question. In Whirl Away, you have this beautiful and wise line: sad people know the great secret of life, that it's not going to work out as you'd hoped. It seems like it might be coming from you as well as the narrator, Eddie Plum. Is that something that you would say is this sad secret?
I would think so. And I think that Americans are very poorly prepared for that reality.
Yes, we're very optimistic.
Yeah. And that's why we get so depressed. I think that's why our suicide rate is going up, and we're the most medicated planet. I mean, most medicated country on the planet, that we're just virulently unhappy people because we have a different expectation of.
Well, it's been in the news a lot lately with Anthony Bourdain and designer in New York, Kate Spade.
It makes no sense for these people to take their lives, but somehow they, it didn't add up the way they thought it would.
Yeah, I've got two friends who committed suicide, and I can't say there was, like in the documentary, a lot of people were saying there was no signs of the math professor wanting to kill himself.
Right.
And I can't say there were any signs of people I know actually did. I mean, there was no question about it.
Right.
You just wonder what was going through their head and wish you had kind of caught on to it sooner and there was something you could do. I shouldn't feel any guilt, but in a way, I felt maybe I should have.
Of course.
Maybe I should have done something.
But I think if you're more attuned or prepared for the tragic aspect of life, it's easier to take, because here you have everything and you're still not happy. And I think that's when you really start to have to confront some things that you weren't expecting. And that's where, a sharp descent might begin.
And you even mentioned, I think, in the documentary that's actually the first precept of Buddhism is life is suffering. So get used to it.
Yes.
And there's some good parts of the suffering, too. I mean, it leads to compassion, hopefully.
Exactly. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. Suffering leads to all kinds of extraordinarily good things, as long as you deliberately, immerse yourself in it. But tragic cultures all these Catholic cultures are tragic. They're built around the idea of death, and they're just better at it than we are. So these people, you go down to Mexico, and why is everybody so happy? They're poor. They're under the thumb of the narcotraficantes, and they have to do whatever the United States say, and they're being disrespected in the media. But they're basically much happier than we are, and it's just because they're properly aligned with the essential.
They have a Day of the Dead, so they celebrate the dead.
Yes, yeah,
and they know that someday they'll be in the same position.
Exactly, and it's all going to fall apart, and everything's going to be lost, and everybody you know is going to die. Mm-hmm. And I think Americans deliberately keep their attention away from this for as long as possible. I don't know why you can't just incorporate.
We're in denial.
Yeah, just incorporate it into your worldview, and then go have a beer and do what you normally do. You don't. It doesn't require. You don't have to. You don't have to go.
Well, Poe Ballantyne, has been a great pleasure and privilege. I just love your work. Talking with you today on KBOO. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
We've been talking with Poe Ballantyne, author of the new book Whirl Away, the great American loony bin, horse plane, and record collecting novel, published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Poe and his son Tom for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening. KBOO.
illuminated spinning around at the top of this display are not only wonderful to see, but beautiful to hear. Ask for the RCA Victor 45 RPM record catalog right now. Check the records you want to hear. Try them on the demonstration player. You'll be amazed at the clarity, the beauty, the joy of a record recorded entirely within the quality zone.